I'm Raheem Edwards, and you're listening to The Sound of the Loons.
Morning, afternoon, or evening, depending on when this finds you. Welcome to the Sound of the Loons podcast. I'm Steve McPherson, and I'm naturally joined by my bosom buddy, Callum Williams. I'm happy to say that we're recording this podcast today in the friendly confines of Allianz Field, where the first team just wrapped up practice a short while ago. This is all, of course, in anticipation of the home opener this weekend against New York Red Bulls, presented by Star Tribune. The game kicks off at 6 p.m. Central Time, but the gates will be open a little earlier than usual. Normally, you would be 90 minutes before kick. It's going to be 2 hours, so they'll open at 4 p.m. And you can enjoy happy half-hour pricing on canned beers, pizza, soda, popcorn, all the stuff that you love to eat. I am a total sucker for popcorn. I would eat popcorn 24 hours a day if I could. And then beginning at 3:30 p.m. on the Great Lawn, there will be food trucks and other entertainments, including a live performance at 4:30 p.m. by hip-hop artist Nerd D. I think that's correct. It's N-U-R-D. It could be Nerd, but there's another band called Nerd. So I think it's Nerdy, like you're nerdy.
I like the way you're looking at me as if I have the answer to this.
I just wanted a little, you know, support.
Okay.
To say yeah.
Sure. Yes.
All right, cool.
Absolutely.
There remain a limited number of tickets available for the home opener. And honestly, it looks like it's going to be a great Minnesota spring day taking a little soccer. So head over to mnufc.com/tickets to get yours today. All right. Now down to business. A serious amount of goal scoring mixed between some new players, some veterans, just a massive margin of victory. But enough about Leicester over Aston Villa.
Whoa, come on.
Hey. Just throwing it out there. Yeah, all right, let's talk about Minnesota United. Two away games, 6 points. Not bad.
No, not bad at all. Very, very, very good start. And I was extremely impressed with the front four against San Jose on Saturday. And, you know, look, what I will say is the Earthquakes didn't have their best day, no doubt about it. I thought Guram Kashia was dreadful. I thought the goalkeeper, Daniel Vega, was perhaps had his worst game in Major League Soccer.
Yeah.
But the point is Minnesota United took full advantage of that. And it ended up with five, but it really could have been six, seven, or eight, Steve. You know, it was endless, flawless attacks from Minnesota United. And, you know, I was very impressed with them. You know, they unsurprisingly, being away from home, they didn't have as much possession as you would have thought, but sometimes that doesn't matter. You know,
sure,
they made the most of the possession they did have. I thought they were great moving forward. The front four were great. Finlay, again, was fabulous. I thought, obviously, Ike Opara deservingly awarded the Bell Bank Man of the Match and the Player of the Week in MLS as well. You know, so it's right now, it's perhaps been the most perfect start Minnesota have had to a season. And now we have four home games ahead of us.
Yeah, I will admit, so this game, we talked about this a little bit last week. You win that first game and you're thinking, hey, you expect draws on the road, wins at home. That's the baseline. So you come out of those first two games with 2 points. Great. We already had 3 points heading into the second game. So I'm like, hey, a draw is great. 4 points out of the first two games. I had a little issue with my internet at home. So I had to go over to our social media manager's spot, Mike Shields, to watch the game. And, you know, it only revealed itself right as the game was starting. So I was a little late. I got there about 15 minutes in. I was like, oh, Minnesota's already winning.
Yeah.
You know, so, and from there, I just wanted to touch on Vega again because you brought it up. A good goalkeeper, but just one of those situations where it just seemed like a nightmare game. And I found myself thinking about it with regards to goalkeepers in particular. Again, one of the unique challenges for them is that I've talked about this before with a couple different people that, you know, there's certain sports, soccer is one of them, where your effort level can lift you up, right? Like if the game is not going, you can sort of redouble your effort. If you just run more and run faster and run harder, it can get better. It's one of the major challenges with golf as a game, because there is no effort other than stepping up to the tee and hitting that ball. It's sort of that you have a lot of time to think about what's going wrong or going right between holes. Mm-hmm. And I think that goalkeepers in some sense have some of that going for them. If you miss that first, if you let one in and you go, well, that was one, right? But then you let another one in, it's like it can really snowball. And that's kind of how it felt for Vega. Like it just sort of seemed by the end of the game, like he just couldn't get his feet under him in the right places and was just misjudging stuff.
Yeah, goalkeeping, I would argue more than most positions in football is probably, from a psychological point of view, the most intriguing position because you have a lot more time to think about things.
Right.
I'm not suggesting that nothing happens when the ball is nowhere near the goalkeeper or not at their feet or in their hands or whatever, because goalkeepers are always watching the game. They're always, the majority of them are barking out instructions because they can see the whole field.
Right.
Particularly to the back line as well. So, it's from a psychological point of view, it's a really intriguing position. And, maybe that was the case on Saturday and Vega psychologically collapsed. But there were some of the goals, in my opinion, and taking nothing away from the goals because the players were in the position to score them. But I thought there were one or two that he should have done a lot better on.
Sure.
And then on the flip side, there were one or two where I thought Minnesota should have done better in front of goal as well. So, look, it catch 22, I guess, but it wasn't a great day for him in goal. It wasn't a great day defensively for the Earthquakes at all, but it was a very good day for Minnesota from an attacking point of view. And, we've seen them rip apart the Earthquakes. We've seen them do excellent against a very good Portland Timbers team. And now the question is, can they continue to be as consistent as they have been in the opening parts of the season?
Yeah. Speaking of possession, I believe that Minnesota actually has the lowest percentage of possession through two games of any team in the league currently, and yet they have two wins. It seems quite clear that Adrian Heath knows how to play against San Jose. Even if it's not his preferred style, which he's like a lot of coaches, he would prefer to have more of the ball to be able to control the game that way. But I think it speaks well to him that he's willing to muck it up, to say like, this is what we're going to be able to get from this. San Jose with that man marking scheme, you saw a lot of what we talked about, pinpoint passing, moving it quickly from player to player. And as soon as players were giving up the ball, they were running ahead. Mm-hmm. That's huge against a team like San Jose. The effort is one of the biggest things. Speaking of efforts, second effort staying with it, Robin Lud got his first MLS goal off the rebound from Luis Amarilla's penalty shot. I still maintain that I think Lud is always, Adrian has said that he's going to score goals and he's going to assist goals. And I believe those things are going to happen. But I still maintain that I think he does a lot of things that aren't showing up on the score sheet week to week. A couple of times he's been just unlucky with a shot. Here he was lucky. He was there he was the guy there to tap in, to put that ball in. Speaking of ones that I feel like Vega should have been able to stop. I mean, it sort of went right at him, but
yeah, he wasn't really
prepared, I think, for that second. He stopped the first one and then wasn't quite crisp enough to get up in time for it, it seemed like. But so we've talked about Robin Lud before. If it's possible, we know that Kevin Molino came off this past game with a bit of a hamstring issue, which to my mind, given the depth the team has and given some of his issues he's had, better to, play cautious with him. If he's good to go, he's good to go. That's great. We saw Hassani Dotson come in place of him, which sort of moved the team into a kind of a hybrid 4-3-3, 4-2-3-1. He's a little more central, I think, but he also played on the front foot for a lot of that game as well. Mm-hmm. Hassani is not an option at this point because he was called up to the U23 team for Olympic qualifying, which is great. Congrats to Hassani Dotson. What do you think happens now if Molino can't go? Do you think we see Lud go pull in central? You've heard he can play in that number 10 position. Who do we see out left? Like what do you think so far? I mean, it's early in the week. We don't know, but
Lud will move into the 10 role and Raheem Edwards will be on the left-hand side. That would not surprise me at all.
Yeah.
And I know straight away, cause I can hear it through the radio and through the laptops and every other way that people are listening to this. I can hear people saying, what about Thomas Chacon? I can hear them saying it.
Yeah.
Chacon, he'll be on the roster if this is the case, if Molino doesn't play. He is begging for an opportunity. But as I've said before, Steve, I've not been particularly impressed with him over the course of the last couple of weeks in training in particular. But, you know, if Molina is unavailable, then it wouldn't surprise me if Chacon was on the bench and ready to go. That doesn't necessarily mean he's going to get on the field.
Right.
But I think Raheem Edwards, from what he's shown in training, what he's shown in the last couple of minutes that he's come on against San Jose, and in preseason, you know, he had a very, very good preseason, a really good preseason.
Absolutely.
And let's not forget his caliber as well. He's 24. But he's won an MLS Cup with Toronto FC.
Yeah.
He's played in the Champions League before. He's very experienced for a 24-year-old, and he is a very mature individual as well. I was quite surprised when we first had interactions with him how put together he was. And not suggesting I thought he was a hooligan or anything, but I didn't think he would be as well kept as he is and well put together. He's surprised just about everybody.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was a tremendous piece of business when they got him in from Chicago. And as we've said before, good luck to Wyatt Olmsberg. But Olmsberg, in my opinion, probably wasn't going to crack this first team. So to get in somebody of Raheem Edwards' stature, and Chicago Fire paid $400,000 for him a year ago, let's not forget.
Yeah.
It's a tremendous piece of business by Mark Watson, and well done to him for doing that. And, you know, it's, as we've said numerous times already, Steve, the depth on this roster is the best it's ever been. There's no question, and it's because of players like Raheem Edwards we can make that statement.
Yeah, I think a thing that's important to keep in mind with regards to Chacon and his minutes or his, you know, his immediate future in terms of getting onto the pitch is that I think that fans overall probably underrate the importance of consistency within a team. I think when you look at people talking about it, it's like, well, why not try this, try that, try this, like try throw this guy here, try this formation. I appreciate how that's attractive as an idea, and the idea of experimentation is interesting and it's novel, and obviously there's some benefits that can come from flexibility. But I think that there's so much benefit to be had by consistency of expectation and consistency of performance. And Adrian, from day one, has always said, I mean, the players pick the team. Like, they pick themselves by their effort. And I think if you look at, you know, in training, Raheem Edwards versus Thomas Chacon, like, Raheem has blown him out of the water right now, in the first, over preseason, in the first weeks of the season right now. And I think that if you keep that consistent, if that is what players expect and that's what players understand, you have to, and you stick to that, that becomes its own value. And you say, this guy has worked the hardest. He's shown the best in training. He goes in when somebody else is out. And then if you want to get that spot, that's what you do. And I think that if you start messing with that, if you start paying attention, you know, to what people want or what the narrative is or what the expectation is or how much a guy was paid or how much they paid for him, as soon as it becomes inconsistent, then I think you start seeing the dissolution of some of the fabric that keeps a team together. And so I think it's easy. It's easy if you're clear. This is effort is rewarded on game days when we need guys. And mm-hmm. I think if you stick and by that metric, I think Raheem is in that spot.
Yeah, and also going back to the depth as well, another person who was absolutely necessary in the dying embers of the San Jose game was Aaron Schoenfeld. There's a reason why he was brought in. And at that stage of the game, possession was very important. Aaron Schoenfeld gives Minnesota that option to be direct and to hold the ball up.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was the right move by Adrian Heath to bring on Aaron Schoenfeld and possess a little more. You know, I know the scoreline, it was 5-2. The game was more or less over. But, you know, sometimes, you know, what he came on with, what, 10 minutes to go or something? You know, a lot can change in 10 minutes in this game.
Sure.
So bringing on somebody who you know is going to maintain possession, who's not going to give the ball away as much and can play off of... you know, the three players behind, or as it was, the two players behind then. I thought it was, you know, again, a tremendous showing of the depth that Minnesota United have. And there'll be times when Mason Toy is the more sensible option, no doubt about it.
Mm-hmm.
If Minnesota are chasing the game, for example, and they need a bit of speed, they need to get in behind a little more, and they maybe need to stretch the back line a little more to create spaces for the three behind the forwards. But I thought on Saturday, Aaron Schoenfeld was the obvious and right option, and it proved to be the case in the end.
Yeah. Let's talk about a couple other individual performances. Aiko Parra won Player of the Week, as you mentioned, deservedly so. I don't know if he can mount another Defender of the Year campaign simply because the turnaround was so drastic last year. I mean, that to spearhead that kind of defensive turnaround in terms of, you know, goals conceded and everything like that, you'd sort of need that effort somehow again, which would mean giving up something like 10 goals this year to sort of get that same result. But I feel like it's, if it hasn't been crystal clear to people already, it's becoming more and more clear that he is the most important player on this team. I think just in as a leader, as an anchor in the back line, as someone to just break up any kind of attack that's coming forward. And now, you know, aerially on headers, you know, we saw some last year and, you know, he's already got 2 goals this season. He's on the same pace as Luis Amarilla, who wants 25 goals this season. I can't say enough good things about Ike Opara.
Ike Opara's exactly what this team needed at this stage last year. And as you say, 2019 MLS Defender of the Year, deservedly so. He was great. I'll take issue with the fact that you think he's the most important player on the team.
All right.
Because I still think that I would argue Ozzy Alonso is still absolutely vital to how this team wants to play in terms of possession and quick turnover and whatnot. I think Jan Gregus is starting to be amongst that conversation now as well. I think Molino, when he's fit and when he's in the form that he was in Portland, I don't think there's a player that Minnesota have that can change a game as quickly as Molino does. But look, I mean, yeah, obviously Ike Opara defensively, you're probably right, probably the most important defender that Minnesota have, taking nothing away from Michael Boxall, who's been flawless as well. But this team is just so deep right now, Steve. Even if, you know, Opara or Boxall were to go down with an injury, you know, hopefully in a couple of weeks, there'll be Brent Coleman available. And if it was to happen this week, Jose Aja is available. And, you know, Aja was a starter for someone like Vancouver a couple of years ago, you know, and he started a lot of games for Orlando. And I've never seen a roster as deep as this one. And the good thing is as well is that the roster got a bit younger as well, which is what they were looking to do. You know, bringing in some of the younger lads like Raheem Edwards and Ja'Cory Hayes, you know, and even Aja, who's in his mid to late 20s, you know, it's something the team wanted to do, and I'm glad they've been able to do it in the manner in which they have, and even Tyler Miller as well. I think Miller has been fabulous so far. You know, the only things that have gotten past him have been penalty kicks, you know, and a deflected effort, you know, and that's it. So I think this team, as I said, Steve, I'll continue to say it. I think it's the best team that Minnesota have had. I think it's probably, and I think he'll say this as well, it's probably the best team Adrian Heath has had since he's come in to North America.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think that it sort of spun as simply getting younger, but it's like hitting that, like, guys in their mid-20s with experience who still have room to grow a little bit more into their primes. Like, it's just such a sweet spot of guys. And we've talked about it before with Raheem Edwards, where he had, you know, a very good start to his MLS campaign, a little up and down and uneven since then. A guy like James Musa, who sort of bounced around in a couple different places, had a great season in USL last season. To get those guys who have that, you know, again, that trade is like Wyatt, you know, was a little bit younger and, you know, you weren't sure like where the development was going, to get Raheem Edwards for him. You've sort of, again, it's these guys in that real sweet spot of they're young. And so they're athletic. They bring a little more physicality and speed to the game. But they have room to get better from where they're also not a finished product, which is great. You mentioned Jan Gregus. I wanted to mention him also, made the team of the week. His service on corner kicks was stupendous. I mean, after we saw, you know, he was brought in as sort of a set piece specialist. It was a little uneven to start the season last year. It's on point right now. And he threw in one of those Sasani Dathan style bangers. And through 2 games, he has 2 assists and a goal. I feel like my preseason prediction of him stepping up big in his second year, I feel like I seem pretty prescient right now.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, you fit the nail on the head there, Steve. And look, this is what should be happening. He's now had a year to adjust, not only to the way that football is played in this country, but to the lifestyle here as well, and how to live here. And you know, I think he's certainly taken on, I mentioned it earlier on, he's taken on more of a role for sure in the locker room. You can see him putting his arm around players and whatnot, some of the younger lads, for example. And you know, as I mentioned earlier on about Raheem Edwards, you know, being, I thought he would have been a lot more raw. I didn't realize he was well put together as he is as a player and stuff. And there was a few times in training where you could tell he was getting frustrated because he does have a bit of an edge to him. Mm-hmm. And Jan Gregers put his arm around him and said, you know, you're okay, you know, carry on doing what you're doing, you know. And
yeah.
Look at the coaches, they're excited, they can see what you're doing. And Minnesota, for the first 2 years, didn't have leaders like this. And now we have an abundance of them.
Yeah.
With Gregush and Alonso and Michael Boxall and Ike Opara, the spine of this team has never been stronger. Jan Gregush is great in terms of we're working on this throughout the preseason, and I saw it clearly in the second game against Portland in the Portland preseason tournament, where they would get the ball into the two central midfielders very quickly indeed, and then they would play it even quicker up to the three behind the forwards. And that's what I think San Jose were struggling a little bit over the weekend to deal with that, to deal with how quickly the ball was getting pressed forwards, accompanied by the movement off the ball of Amaria that created so much space. Mm-hmm. That's twice now in two games that Amaria has caused havoc with his movement off the ball, and it's allowed the other players to move around. And especially with the way San Jose play as well, I couldn't believe, Steve, I thought it was borderline naive that Almeida would have somebody marking, for example, Ethan Finlay on the right-hand side. He'd have Nick Lima as tight as possible. And if Finlay, all he's got to do is maneuver inside and Lima would follow him. And Romain Metanier has a clear space ahead of him. And there's so much space there. I couldn't believe that Almeida was sticking with this. And, mm-hmm. and look, I know Lima got taken off at halftime because he wasn't great. And Salinas was a little more disciplined. But I just couldn't believe that after a year of doing this, where it was okay for San Jose, it would cause problems, but if you know how to play against it, which it's obvious Adrian Heath and Minnesota yeah. United do, why do it again? So I thought it was a bit bizarre, to be honest, that they... I understand the first 30 minutes tried out,
sure.
but it was obvious there was no backup plan. They had no way to cope with yeah. Minnesota United. And
yeah.
you know, I just thought it was bizarre. But that is also credit to Minnesota United and the homework they did during the week and obviously knowing how to play against a side like San Jose. But, I thought some really intelligent movement off the ball from the front four, for sure. And, again, Ethan Finlay, I thought, was great. I thought Robin Lurds... it was good, and even when Molino came off, I thought Dotson playing a little higher than the other two caused issues. But Amaria again, Steve, just yeah. the movement off the ball causes so much trouble.
Yeah, that, I wanted to touch just briefly on Amaria, Cal, for that. It's sort of what you're saying that I think he's really showing, and maybe this seems obvious, but really showing the utility of flexibility at the front line there in terms of his movement, his distribution. You know, he got an assist in the game. Sort of different ways to be threatening, running away from the ball, running onto the ball, drawing defenders, things like that. It's something that Minnesota United has not really had yet. It sort of seemed like with, you know, we sort of Angelo Rodriguez thing was hold up play. And that was sort of, but you knew what you were getting when the other team knew what to expect with Angelo Rodriguez. He was going to look to get into a guy and hold up the ball, right? And you could see it when Angelo would get the ball in space suddenly with the ball at his feet. It was like, what are you going to do? Mm-hmm. Like he didn't really have a lot of utility there. So I think that you're seeing with Amaria, it's like he can affect the game in so many different ways. It just keeps the other team off balance, and that's a big thing, I think.
I think the thing with Angelo Rodriguez, and I say this with all due respect because I know he's had a decent start back down in Colombia, he in a salary cap league, his output was not enough, and he was too expensive for what he gave back.
Right.
And that's not necessarily his fault.
No, certainly not.
So, I know he started well back down in South America, when you bring on someone like Aaron Schoenfeld, who I don't know what he's earning, but it's going to be nowhere near what Angelo Rodriguez was earning. Right. He's a really good depth piece. And again, it just gives Minnesota so many different options off the bench and how to play. And, you know, what I will say as well, Steve, is I thought defensively, I thought the shape was really, really good as well. We've seen this for a long time now. When Minnesota get comfortable, they do divert back to it's almost a 4-4-1-1. And there is a flat four in midfield.
Yeah.
And that causes problems for people because they can't necessarily find the gaps that would be there before. And, I just thought, honestly, Steve, I think this is the most organized team I've seen Minnesota have. I said this earlier on today when we've been watching the team train here at Allianz Field. I just don't fear any MLS team when they're playing here at Allianz Field. Yeah. I just think this is such a fortress for this team. And given the momentum that they have already, I can't see anything but a win against the Red Bulls here on Sunday.
Yeah. All right, we're going to veer precipitously away from soccer briefly, sort of like a palate cleanser here. Sometimes we talk about stuff at the beginning of the podcast and we get into the soccer. I thought I'd throw it in the middle here. So I want to talk about jam bands. And I don't know if you care anything about jam bands, but I just had a jam band experience this week. So
What's
a jam band? Good question. Thank you. For people in England who might not know or the listeners at home, a good example of a jam band is Phish, a band from Vermont with a rabid following. I would say that jam bands arose to prominence sort of in the 90s, which is sort of what I'm going to talk about, with bands who sort of cut their teeth on playing a lot and playing these long shows and, you know, sort of in the spirit of the Grateful Dead, this idea of the sort of extended improvisation and sort of going way out there and a lot of pyrotechnical guitar abilities and things like that. It's not a genre I listen to now, barely at all, but there was this band that I loved sort of circa high school and then early into college called the Hatters, and they were a jam band. They came out of New York City, a scene that was in New York City that also spawned the Spin Doctors. You may have heard of the Spin Doctors.
You're going to be incredibly disappointed with my lack of naivety.
Two Princes?
Here.
Do you know the song Two Princes?
No.
Okay, Blues Traveler?
No. Nope.
Okay, all right. So they were the same scene as those two bands. The thing about the Hatters is they had like a very distinct two guitar thing where they had two lead guitarists, and it was sort of like the Allman Brothers. Have you heard of the Allman Brothers band?
I have heard of the Allman Brothers.
Okay, all right.
Yes.
So they had a little more of a Southern rock feel, you know, which gave them a different thing. The Allman Brothers were also sort of a jam band. The thing about the Hatters is they never made it. They were signed to Atlantic Records. And this came up in this other podcast I was listening to, a podcast called Reply All, that has a fantastic episode this week. I recommend everybody listen to it. It's been sort of making the rounds on social media. It's about this song that this guy remembered, but he couldn't remember anything about it. And he couldn't find anything about it. So they go into this mystery of why does this guy know a song that no one has heard of? And they figure this stuff out. But in terms of investigating this comes up that, so the Hatters were signed to Atlantic Records, you know, in the mid to late 90s, which was a time when the record industry was making just like a stupid amount of money. Like this is pre-streaming. CDs cost $18, $19 when they weren't on sale at Sam Goody. So they were making so much money. Labels would, the model then was sort of labels would sign bands, give them a stack of cash to sort of make a record or whatever. And then that was kind of it. They gave them some money. And then it was like, if the record made money, if suddenly it was a hit, it was a huge return on the investment because they had just laid out some, like what was to them a piddling amount of money. If it didn't hit, it meant nothing to lose $50,000, $100,000, like while the band themselves sort of racked up debt supporting the album. So the Hatters broke up in like 95 or 96 and just like disappeared. The members went off and did other stuff. But I had sort of forgotten about them. They were sort of my favorite band back then. But their stuff is now up on streaming on Spotify, which is great. And I went down sort of like a mini rabbit hole of like, I'm going to go listen to these records I haven't really listened to in like 20 years or something. And I have to tell you, they're not great. Like it's not like I discovered something that I'm like, oh man, this band was much better than I thought they were. They're goofy. There's a song about racing frogs. I mean, it's just like they have this sort of off the deep end weirdo mythology about all this weird stuff, right? The guitar is still very good and everything like that. But the thing that I really wanted to say is that it really awakened in me this appreciation for the fact that they didn't really seem to care what anybody thought about them in a way that I just don't think a lot of music is made that way these days. There's really this feel of like, we like playing with each other. We like playing, we like writing songs. If you guys are here for that, great. If you're not, I mean, we're still going to do it because we just enjoy this thing, you know, regardless of the consequences. And it was really refreshing to listen to that because I feel like so much of what we consume these days, like from music, movies, TV, there's like a lot of concern, not just from the people who are in charge of it, the people who make money, the studios, the labels and everything like that, but the actual musicians, the creators, about how their fans feel about what they're making. I mean, we run into this with sports and sort of the discourse on social media. It's so easy to give your feedback about everything constantly. And I think that creators often either try to sort of conform to it or they're like openly antagonistic to it. They're like, I don't engage in that in a sort of, they sort of take a position that informs their music. But, you know, some of these jam bands, it just sort of felt like they just didn't care. It was kind of like, this is the music, and if you like it, then great. And it's just kind of nuts to me that any of these bands were reasonably popular, like that Spin Doctors or Blues Traveler had hits on MTV, because, again, it's sort of, they wrote some pop songs, but mostly they liked, you know, playing live shows and, like, playing 10-minute songs and stuff like that. So it's just kind of fun to hear something that doesn't really care whether you like it or not.
Yeah, in today's world, particularly where just about everybody is offended as easily as possible. Yeah, I would agree with that. In terms of music at the moment, Steve, I was having this conversation with someone the other day. I don't get excited by music anymore. I don't remember the last time a record came out. Record, song.
I still call them records. Okay, so there we go. It's all right. I still buy them.
I can't remember the last time one came out, and I thought to myself, "Oh, you know, wow, that's a really good song," and it got me excited and made the hair stand on the back of the neck. You know, yeah. I haven't, you know, and maybe it's just because I'm just getting older and not really in tune with what's going on nowadays and not down with the kids anymore. But I just, I don't know. I was listening to, like, this morning, I was getting ready to come to the stadium, and I blasting the Rolling Stones, and I was like, you know, music just, it's so different now, you know.
Yeah.
And I was certainly one of those kids back home in England that were into the trance and dance and techno type music, as well as the sort of the indie rock and roll stuff.
Sure.
But even now, when you think of groups from those two genres I just mentioned, I just don't get excited by it anymore. And I'm not necessarily saying that music is any worse now. I don't know why. I just don't get excited by it anymore.
Yeah, I think there's a couple different dimensions to that. I mean, part of it is we do get older, and so it's, you know, we're not as engaged with it constantly. I do wonder sometimes what we've lost in terms of having streaming and Spotify and things like that, because, you know, it used to be you had to sort of make a hobby of following music. You had to put in some time and, you know, some legwork in terms of, you know, tracking down hard to find CDs. I mean, I remember going on GEMM, which was this great website for, you could find out of print stuff, and you could, you know, you would go to the record store and you would special order things. They would find you things on import. You know, you would sort of like every Tuesday go in there and see what the new releases are. You'd have to go to a place to put on headphones to listen to the music before you bought it, and then decide if you wanted to buy it or not. I mean, I remember these great record stores like Other Music in New York when I lived there, where you would go in and there would be like staff recommendations, and they would have a little write-up of something. And I discovered a ton of stuff that is still stuff I love through that, through, you know, employees saying like, this is a record store saying, this is what I want, or this is what I like. This is, I recommend this if you like these other bands and things like that. You know, that stuff is so present constantly now. Like, you're, oh, it's a playlist by this person I like. Here's all the music. But you just turn it on, and then as soon as you somebody talks to you, you just turn it off, and you don't, you know, it's like, it's hard to sometimes carve out those spaces for really appreciating it. So I don't know. I mean, there's still stuff that gets released that I get really excited about. There's still artists I get excited about. But I feel you. It feels a little, it's almost too easy.
Yeah, well, and this is going to date me terribly now, but I remember on a Sunday afternoon in the UK, they used to have the top 40 songs that were going on at the time, you know, the chart music and stuff. And I would sit there on a Sunday afternoon, and I'd have several favorite songs that were in the charts at the time. But, you know, I was a kid, I didn't have any money to go and buy the albums or whatever. So what I would do, I would get a tape recorder, and I would stay there by the radio, hit record when the song came on that I wanted, and obviously press stop then. And you have to time it out just right, because if you don't, you get the start of what the DJ is just about to say as he's pitching to the next song or something, you know. And that's what we had to do. That's what we had to do to literally craft our own album. And yeah, like you said, it perhaps there was a little more of a lust for music then, because it wasn't as easily accessible. And that's not necessarily a bad thing now. I think it's great that you can get music as easily as we can. But yeah, I do wonder if we've lost a certain romanticism about it. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, moving on, that was my palate cleanser. Let's talk about Red Bulls. Red Bulls have a win and a draw through the first two games. The win was at home against FC Cincinnati, 3-2, not a super flattering scoreline overall against FC Cincinnati. They also got a draw against RSL in Salt Lake, which, good. It's up to play in Utah, and that and it's at altitude and everything like that. But that was also on a Demir Krylock goal and stoppage time sort of brought it level. And then Cincinnati also pulled within one in like the final 10 minutes of the game. The Red Bulls seem, you know, like they're still well coached. They still have that identifiable style, which Adrian alluded to, you know, that they're going to press, they're going to attack, they're going to try to win that ball and get it back up the field as soon as they can. But it does sort of feel like they seem vulnerable right now.
I would agree that they still have their identity that they've had for many years, but the question is now, do they have the players to do it?
Yeah.
Looking at the 11 that started against Salt Lake, this is not surprising because the Red Bulls, as far as I'm aware, the Red Bulls are still at the top of the charts in terms of how many academy players have come straight into the homegrown system and become professional players. So their identity has changed big time over the last 10 years because you think about it, you know, 10, 9, 8 years ago, it was Rafa Márquez, Thierry Henry, yeah. Joel Impero, all these types of players that were coming over from Europe. And now it's, you know, they have a lot of the younger players. You know, Davis in the centre of midfield has been a part of the academy and has been a regular for a couple of years. But the other players like Duncan, who I thought was actually very good against Salt Lake, and White, the centre forwards, Barlow as well, a young player who's come through the ranks as well. They're just a little bit that they aren't the Red Bulls that they used to be. And I'm interested to see what they look like in a couple of years, because if these kids keep playing at this level, then they're going to be very good, of right. course, if they're effective. You know, look, they still have some decent players like Shatkovsky in midfield is good. Daniel Royer is obviously very effective as well. Has been for a couple of years.
Valo looked really good.
Valo looked good. You know, Cáceres did okay as well. The big one for them, though, Steve, and I do wonder if he's got enough about him. They need more from Kaku. They simply need more from him.
Yeah.
He came off against Salt Lake, and he was just okay. And I do wonder if he's not having a good game, I wonder if he's one of these players. But if he doesn't have a good game, the Red Bulls don't have a good game, you know, because he's so important to how they work. And you know, defensively they're vulnerable as well. I know they just signed a left back from the second division in France as well. I don't know if he's going to be available on Sunday, but that could potentially help them. But having Amaral Tarek at centre-half, who's not a centre-back, hurt them. You know, obviously Aaron Long is still injured, allegedly. I don't know what the situation there is. I don't know if his head's been turned because there was a bid turned down from the Premier League with West Ham. Tim Parker is still one of the best centre-halves in Major League Soccer for me as well. And they have a new goalkeeper as well in Jensen. So I've said this before, I think this is a transitional year for the Red Bulls. They've been about as consistent as can possibly be in MLS in terms of getting to the playoffs every year, and then they always seem to fall short. So I don't know, that they're about as unrecognizable of a side in MLS, in my opinion, right now, compared to what they used to be. So, and that's not necessarily a bad thing, but when you become unrecognizable, it's because you don't really have an identity. And whilst they still have that identity from years gone by that Jesse Marsh instilled, I still don't know what to expect from the Red Bulls this year.
Yeah.
I don't know. I just don't know what to think of them. My only thought is that they are weaker than what they were last year from a personnel point of view.
Mm-hmm.
I'm intrigued to see what they have, what happens with them, Stephen, what they can offer. But they are a lot younger. And again, that's not necessarily a bad thing, but I'm just intrigued to see where they are at the midpoint of the season, because with what they have right now, I'm not convinced they're going to be over the line when it comes to the end of the season.
Yeah, the identity question is an interesting one that I think it sort of brings up a sort of chicken and an egg issue with, you know, this is, if your identity is this, but you don't have the personnel to execute it so that it can be seen or felt, is it your identity anymore? You know, you can want to play, you know, if you're a coach who's like, I want to play a possession-based football, but you don't have the personnel to do that, does it really matter? Mm-hmm. Like, if that's what you think the identity is. Like, I mean, any of us, it's like, oh, this is who I am. It's like, well, are you actually like that? Or are you just going to act like that, but you can't really, you're not going to be able to hold it up. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens at Allianz Field. We've talked before about the question of, you know, do teams start playing Minnesota a little differently at Allianz Field? Mm-hmm. Is there more of a sort of a sitting back? I don't see Red Bulls sitting back, basically, no matter what, again, because of this idea of the identity they want to sort of impress upon other teams. So this might not be the best litmus test for how Minnesota plays with more of the ball. They might still end up with not as much of the ball as the Red Bulls, but could still win, I think.
Yeah, I think, like you said, it depends on what philosophy they adapt. Do they carry on with their own, you know, pressing sort of game, or do they remain a little deeper, which would suit Minnesota, by the way, if they remain deep. But, you know, I think the Minnesota United of last year would have had an issue with teams sitting deep.
Yeah.
But I think because the front four now are about as lethal as can possibly be, and because there's threats from just about every area on the field, I do think if the Red Bulls are pinned back inside their own area, all that's going to do is invite pressure from Minnesota. Mm-hmm. And eventually they will break through. So I'm intrigued to see it, Steve. I really am. I can't wait for Sunday. It's so good to be back home. You know, yeah. After all the traveling with preseason and then the first two games, I'm happy to be home. So I'm sure the players are absolutely thrilled. So it's going to be interesting, and I can't wait to see, you know, the Wonderwall in all its glory and you know the entirety of the stadium. I can't wait to go and have a drink in the brew hall afterwards and get the light rail to the stadium on a match day. You know, I love doing that. And by the time I usually go, is when the first sort of flickers of Minnesota United fans are out and about, and you can hear them talking about the game and talking about the team, what's Adrian going to do, and I love that on a match day, you know. So I can't wait, Steve. It's going to be great on Sunday. It really is.
Yeah, I feel like about a year ago we were here at Allianz Field before a game had even been played, talking about what it was going to be like. It's pretty exciting to be back in the place again. You know, guys are out there mowing the pitch. Now knowing a little bit of what it's like and thinking about those moments I think I talked about this last season that, you know, there's all this anticipation, and sometimes the anticipation gets in the way of experiencing the place itself. I mean, I think we saw that it was the thing that Ike Opara alluded to in his availability today, that it took about five games for the team to sort of start feeling like it was home. And so sometimes those sort of that anticipation gets in the way of just the natural feel of it. But I think back now to those moments when it was just felt like that pure feeling of joy or excitement at a goal or a stop. You think about, you know, Vito Manone's stop against Dallas. You think about Hassani Dotson's goal that clinched the playoffs. You know, you think about those moments that are going to come. You know, you think about any of Hassani's goals, basically, how exciting all of them were. You think about any of that stuff and the moments that are going to come this season and give you that feeling. It really is like nothing else, I got to say.
Yeah, I can't wait, Steve. I'm fortunate that I've been to just about every MLS stadium now, apart from the new expansion teams, obviously. And the atmosphere here on the match day is fantastic. It's second to none, and I can't wait again. And the only thing I hope, that's not a guarantee, I really hope that we hear the first Wonderwall of the season. Yeah. That would top off just about everything. That would and would. Chris, and what a fabulous start this has been to the campaign.
Yeah, it would make for a great first game. Thanks for joining us for the 95th Sound of the Loons podcast. Minnesota United's next game is on Sunday, March 15th, as the Loons take on the New York Red Bulls in the home opener presented by Star Tribune. Kickoff is set for 6 p.m. Be sure to leave us a nice review on iTunes, or at the very least, a 5-star rating, and follow the team on Twitter at MNUFC, and Cal at CalWilliams.com, and me at Steve Entris. Apologies, as always, to Richard Wagner. And remember, there's only one person in this whole world like you, and people can like you exactly as you are.